Welcome to Slate Money, your guide to the business and finance news of the week. I'm Felix Salmon of Axios, joined by my colleague Emily Peck.
Hello, hello.
And by Elizabeth Spires of the New York Times.
Hello.
We are going to talk about all manner of different stuff today, but we are going to start by talking about New York Community Bancorp, which was kind of rescued by the one and only Steve Mnuchin this week. We're going to talk about Steve Mnuchin, how he's the Zelig of bank crises. We are going to talk about wallets and whether we even need them anymore. We are going to talk about SEC rules about carbon emissions. We have a whole Slate Plus about owner's equivalent rent and inflation and what even is inflation and how much we love the Bureau of Labor Statistics. It's all coming up on Slate Money.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
So, Emily, guess what?
What?
We didn't have a banking failure or banking crisis this week.
We came close, though. And how I know is that Steve Mnuchin was in the news again.
And is Steve Mnuchin, what did you call him, the Zelig of bank crises?
He's the Zelig of bank crises. Every time there's a crisis with banks, he's there. The former U.S. Treasury Secretary, he just shows up in the nick of time, like back in the financial crisis in 08 when he bought IndyMac.
IndyMac failed, and then they sold it to him and his group, and then he renamed it One West because apparently the IndyMac name was tarnished.
Yeah, once your bank fails, you want to get a new name for it. Absolutely. Good idea. Check. Let's just pause. We should really explain what the news is.
Yeah. Elizabeth, what is the news?
So earlier this week, NYCB's stock dropped precipitously from $3.17 to $1.76. And when the value of the company plummeted, Mnuchin stepped in to sort of bail it out at $2 a share.
That was the Matt Levine take. And I don't think it's true. I think that what happened was that earlier this month, or like basically at the end of January, when New York Community released its quarterly earnings, the stock plummeted from like $10 a share to $4 a share. And then about a week ago, it plummeted again from like $4 to $3 when they said that they weren't going to get their annual report out on time because they had weaknesses in risk controls and they wanted to be sure that their remediation was working. And then Moody's downgraded them again for the second time. And then everyone was like, oh shit, this is a really bad look. And that caused the stock to fall to $3. So there were two big pieces of bad news that caused the bank to be in a very bad place. And people knew it was a bad place, and that's why it's stock was trading at a very low $3 a share. And it seems to me that what happened then was that Sandro DiNello, who took over as CEO and who used to be the CEO of Flagstar Bank, which was bought by New York Community Bank, was like, we need to raise a bunch of capital. We really, really need cash, equity. And so he goes around all of the usual suspects. I'm sure he talked to Chris Flowers. I'm sure he talked to Steve Mnuchin. And Steve Mnuchin basically said, well, I can put a consortium together to buy, you know, to invest like $1 billion, but it's basically going to be a take under. I'm going to pay you $2 a share. This is exactly the move that JP Morgan did with Bear Stearns, right? Is that you inject capital at a level way below where the share price is. And the reason I think it happened that way is that when Mnuchin got on the call, he's like, oh yeah, we actually did a whole bunch of due diligence on this. And we went like line by line through their commercial real estate obligations and not just looked at whatever was in the data room, but they phoned up the borrowers and they phoned up the office building owners and the single family rental owners. And they were like, tell me about what your occupancy is, what kind of rents you're getting, what kind of, who's late on their rent and that kind of stuff. They did a bunch of work. This is not an amount of work that you can do between, you know, noon on Friday and 2:30 when the press release goes out, right? This is a substantial amount of diligence. I think what happened was that the Wall Street Journal got wind of the fact that New York Community Bancorp was talking to Mnuchin and wanted the equity. And that was the story that they put out. But they weren't completely up to speed on the idea that the deal was basically done at that point. So what happens is the journal puts out a story saying they want to raise equity, and that causes the stock to plunge to like $1.75, because the worst thing you can do if you're a bank in trouble is admit that you are looking for equity. The best thing you can do is announce that you have received equity. The worst thing you could do is say, I am looking for it. And so for half an hour, it seemed as though they were looking for equity but hadn't found it. Then the stock was halted. And then a couple of hours at 12:30, and then at 2:30, the press release goes out saying, guys, I know you think we're looking for money. In fact, we have found money. In fact, we have found $1 billion, and we have like, and Mnuchin is coming to the rescue. And that caused the stock to bounce way back up again. So that's my view, is that the deal was basically done when the journal article came out. And this was not an opportunistic move by Mnuchin to sort of leak the news, leak something to the Wall Street Journal, cause the share price to fall, and thereby like reduce the price at which he was buying in.
Yeah, I guess I buy it. It's particularly since Mnuchin came in and installed Joseph Otting, who he'd worked with at One West as the new CEO. And Dinello had been CEO for all of a week.
Yeah, Dinello was the chairman of the board. And then what happened was that the old CEO of New York Community Bancorp, this guy Kajemi, I think his name is, was in charge of the ship when it started fucking up its whole risk accounting and stuff, right? So they wind up firing their chief risk officer and their chief accounting officer. Dinello takes over as executive chairman, and I've talked about this executive chairman role on the show before, that it basically means you're running the place without having quite the same amount of accountability. And then he does this call where it's pretty clear that he's running the place. And Kajemi is also on the call, who continues to hold his CEO role, but basically doesn't say anything. And Dinello's like the guy now in charge. And then a couple weeks after that, they put out this new like SEC form saying, oh shit, our accounting was so fucked up that we're not going to be able to get our annual report out on time. And at that point, Kajemi gets kicked out. And the only person who can take over as CEO is Dinello. But I kind of buy the idea that Dinello was not like, I want to run this bank, you know, indefinitely. My job is to rescue this place. And he rescued it by finding Mnuchin and Otting. Otting is an experienced bank CEO. He ran One West. And he's like, you want to take over? That's fine. I will let you take over. So I don't think that Dinello was kicked out so much as that he brought in the new CEO.
I think this story is interesting because it kind of has its roots in the banking crisis we talked about a year ago, in that New York Community Bank was a lot smaller a year ago, and then it wound up buying Signature Bank, which was one of the banks in crisis last year, and it got bigger. Now, Kajemi has blamed this, the fact that it got bigger. He says that's like the root of their problems. It got much bigger and it had to deal with tougher regulations. So that's part of the thing that happened here.
There's this like artificial line in the sand at $100 billion.
Right.
And the FDIC, Emily and I received a lovely email from the FDIC saying that they didn't buy most of Signature Bank. They only bought like $30 billion worth of Signature Bank assets and took on all of the Signature Bank deposits. But the point was that $30 billion or whatever it was, a Signature Bank they did take on, was enough to make the bank bigger than $100 billion. Once you're bigger than $100 billion, the regulators start really breathing down your neck. And they're like, you're in the big leagues now. You've got to be really, you've got to have all of your I's dotted and your T's crossed. And it turns out they didn't have any of that.
Yeah. And so I wonder, like the fact that they had to release that report saying like our risk controls are no bueno, like that happened because they got bigger and like their old risk controls probably were fine enough, didn't matter, but now they really mattered and that helped kind of like precipitate this crisis.
Probably their old risk controls were terrible, but they but like the regulators weren't looking hard enough to find them.
Yeah, also, two things can be true. It can be true that, you know, they were subject to significantly higher regulatory oversight and needed higher capital requirements, but also that Capgemini was just not to deal with it and didn't anticipate it.
So on the one hand, you're like, that's bad. We came to the brink of some kind of crisis. But on the other hand, it's like a bank got bigger. It helped avert the last crisis a year ago. It had to like, it had some growing pains, had to deal with new regulations, tougher regulations. And in the end, Steve came in like he always does. That's his MO. Save the day and all is well.
And what's more, because in between rescuing IndyMac Bank and rescuing New York Community Bank, Steve Mnuchin was Treasury Secretary, as we all know. And his friend Otting, who was the CEO of One West, he installed Otting as the controller of the currency, who's like basically one of the top bank regulators in the US. What that means is that they not only have experience turning around banks and making them better, but they also have a huge amount of experience at the top levels of bank regulation. So the regulators are going to be much more comfortable with them. You can't find the bank CEO who's more friendlier to a regulator than like a former head of the OCC.
Yeah, also, Otting was known during his tenure for gutting the Community Reinvestment Act. And we're not totally gutting it, but what he did was he made some changes to it so that banks could invest in different communities, but they were sort of exempt from prior law that said that they also had to offer financial services to low-income people. So what are the implications of that for him as a CEO of NYCB? Or are there any?
None. Like, I mean, I feel like the CRA stuff is a sideshow here. Things like CRA obligation, community reinvestment obligations, are obligations on banks. They're things that banks, you know, that the at the margin reduce bank profitability and increase the amount that banks have to spend. So regulators in general don't love them. And so, you know, for-profit free market guy like Otting will probably interpret CRA rules more broadly and give banks more leeway to invest CRA funds in the places that they can make the most money from. But ultimately, there has never been a case of a bank, you know, succeeding or failing based on CRA expenditures. Like, that's always marginal. And plus, the other thing is that, say what you will about the how advisable it was for New York Community Bank or to get into this business of lending huge amounts of money to rent-controlled apartments. But you don't get more CRA than lending to rent-controlled apartments, right? I mean, their CRA score is going to be just fine.
Well, every bank CRA score is just fine. All banks do well on the Community Reinvestment Act scoring, as according to the data that I've seen reporting on the CRA. Everyone gets an A.
Everyone gets an A. Yeah, but it's like, no, it's like the Fed stress tests, right? The idea is these are a test that you're designed to pass. The regulators on some level will kind of just like make sure that you're putting enough money to enough places that you will pass it, because it's actually the easiest thing in the world to pass the CRA. I know this because I used to be on the board of a community development credit union. And the only thing you need to do if you're a bank to pass the CRA is write a check to a CDCU and put it in there as what's called a non-member deposit. And like, if you just put like a couple $1 million on deposit at the Lower East Side People's Federal Credit Union, bang, you have now reinvested in your community and you're fine. So like, it literally takes 10 minutes to pass the CRA. It's not hard.
So like, what's the takeaway? So we kind of like walked up to the brink of, can I say this without triggering fear? A bank failure, maybe, but we didn't get one. It's a year since Silicon Valley Bank collapsed and we had that mini banking crisis. FDIC this week came out with some data that shows that there are more banks kind of in trouble right now. What do I make of the banking sector right now? Is it fine?
Structurally speaking, the banking sector is weak right now. The worst thing you can have if you're a bank is high interest rates with a flat yield curve, because you wind up having to pay a lot more money for deposits, and you can't do the core of what banks do, which is maturity transformation. Like the idea of what a bank does is it takes in money at short-term deposits at a low interest rate and then lends them out long-term at a high interest rate. But the yield curve is flat right now, which means you can't lend out the money for a higher interest rate than you're taking it in. And that makes profits very hard to come by. So the macro environment and the rate environment is not good for banks. And if you look at the banking sector broadly, and especially regional banks, most of them are trading below book value, which means we can talk about that, what that means and whether book value is actually what they're worth or not. But it basically means that bank share prices are depressed. And certainly New York Community Bank's share price is depressed even after the bounce back post Mnuchin investment. It's still trading way, way below book value. Book value is like $6.50-ish per share, even with the massive dilution of shares that Mnuchin is doing. But yeah, they had that problem, which is that you can't make money from maturity transformation and you have to pay a lot more money for deposits than you are historically comfortable paying. They also had a little, as of the past week, they began to see the beginnings of a baby bank run. There was not a run on the bank, and they were actually lucky that most of the deposits are under the Flagstar brand, and people who bank with Flagstar weren't realizing that Flagstar was in trouble because all of the headlines were about New York Community Bank. But there were, like, when the second Moody's downgrade happened, a chunk of their, like, uninsured deposits did leave. So there was the beginnings of a bank run there. But yeah, but now they're, like, recapitalized. Their market cap, if you include all of the shares that Mnuchin bought, has basically gone up by $2 billion. They've been placed on review for upgrade by Moody's, and they're, like, a good, solid regional bank now. They're still not worth more than book value. Banks in general, especially regional banks, are not worth more than book value. The banking sector as an industry does not look super attractive, but that's okay. Like, we don't need banks to be super profitable. We don't need banks to be making lots of money for shareholders. All we really need is for banks to not fail. And right now, we seem to have got through this wobble. No other bank seems to be in particular danger. And the banks will survive. And that's all that, like, from a macroprudential point of view, that's all we need.
Hooray. Steve Mnuchin will survive too. I won't say hooray for that.
Here, Nancy Wallace is depositing $5 in her savings account.
She probably thinks of this only as a means of helping herself, building up a reserve fund.
Okay, so before we head to the break, I wanted to tell you guys about our Slate Plus segment this week because it's really fun. It's very nerdy. We're talking about this piece of the inflation report that Felix really hates and I'm really confused by, and we really dig into it and nerd out, yet somehow I feel like this is maybe one of our funner segments in a while. If you're not a Slate Plus member, you might want to subscribe to hear this because Slate Plus members get to hear that segment at the end of the show. And not only do they get to hear the segment, they don't hear ads on Slate podcasts. And you get a bunch of other really great Slate stuff when you sign up for Slate Plus. You get ad-free listening, like I said, on all the podcasts, plus unlimited access to all the stories on slate.com and a members-only newsletter. So you're going to want to sign up at slate.com/plus. That's slate.com/plus.
This podcast is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you're driving, cooking, or doing laundry, Progressive knows the podcasts you listen to go best when they're bundled with another activity, much like how their Progressive home and auto policies go best when they're bundled. Having these two policies together makes taking care of your insurance easier and could help you save, too. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save nearly $800 on average. That's a whole lot of savings and protection for your favorite podcast listening activities, like going on a road trip, cooking dinner, and even hitting the gym. Yep, your home and your car are even easier to protect when you bundle your insurance together. Find your perfect combo. Get a home and car insurance quote at Progressive.com today. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
Your pet is one of a kind, and so is their journey. While every playful moment is a memory in the making, sometimes cats and dogs are a little too good at getting into trouble. That's why you should check out ASPCA Pet Health Insurance. The ASPCA Pet Health Insurance Program offers customizable accident and illness plans, making it easier for pet parents like you to help your pet get the care they may need. The ASPCA Pet Health Insurance Program has been around for over 18 years, and they've helped more than 600,000 pets during that time. They allow you to customize your plan, helping ensure your pet's plan is as unique as they are. Because vet bills can really add up, especially when you're least expecting it. It's simple. Use their app to submit a claim and you'll receive reimbursement for eligible vet bills directly into your bank account. To explore coverage, visit aspcapetinsurance.com/slatemoney. That's aspcapetinsurance.com/slatemoney. Again, that's aspcapetinsurance.com/slatemoney. This is a paid advertisement. Insurance is underwritten by either Independence American Insurance Company or United States Fire Insurance Company and produced by PTZ Insurance Agency Limited. The ASPCA is not an insurer and is not engaged in the business of insurance.
Let's stay in financial services and talk about wallets. Wallets are this wonderful metaphor that you seem to see everywhere. Like when people are rich, everyone says, oh yeah, are you feeling it in your wallet? Or like, oh my God, like it's hurting people right where it hurts, in the wallet. And everyone has a wallet. And the idea is that we're all walking around with a wallet, and the wallet has like foldy green banknotes in it. And then when we pay for something, we reach into our wallet and we take out the foldy green banknotes and we pay for the thing and we get it back. And when was the last time you did that?
I use my wallet almost every day.
But
not with foldy green banknotes,
yeah,
though.
Exactly.
It's really just a device that holds my one credit card that I use and then a bunch of other stuff that I'm not sure what it is, like business cards from like 5 years ago, expired, you know, things that you punched with sandwiches, stuff like that. I mean, it's really a mess.
You never know when you're going to need to know the fax number at the Huffington Post.
You don't know. Someone might want my card. They might want to know that I work.
But yeah, so the wallets are these big, clunky, sort of atavistic things that no one quite knows what they're for, because as you say, all you really need is a credit card. And credit cards can live on your phone now. Like all my credit cards live on my phone. I tap to pay basically for everything. So the idea is, at least according to the New York Times, that we don't need a wallet because you can have your credit card on your phone. And I have to admit that there have been multiple occasions that I have left the house without my wallet and I have been fine, because on most days I do not use my wallet. I carry it around with me and I think to myself, well, it's there if I need it, but I don't need it.
But you don't drive. Because if you drive, I always make sure I have my wallet because my driver's license is in there, and on the off chance I'm pulled over, which has only happened once, I want to have my driver's license, right?
You definitely need to make sure you have your driver's license on you. But now, this is the news hook, I guess. It's not much of a news hook, a vague news hook. Increasing number of states, I think there are like 5 or 6 states which let you have your driver's license on your phone as well. And once you have your driver's license on your phone, at that point, you kind of really don't need a wallet.
What about your health insurance card? Oh, you can have that on your phone too?
I have that on my phone.
I have most of these things on my phone, but it's still, especially if you go to a lot of restaurants and there are a lot of stores that won't take Apple Pay or Google Pay or whatever, you still kind of need a card because it's not so ubiquitous that you can do this everywhere. But just to scope out and say, talk about how popular this is, the stat that sort of provoked this conversation was that 80% of Gen Zers are using mobile wallets. And a lot of them have just given up old school analog physical wallets entirely.
Yeah, but like a lot is, no one actually knows what that number is. And we don't know that it's a lot. Like the using mobile wallets, like that's me, right? I use my mobile wallet every day, carrying around a physical wallet. So that's the next step.
The stat is that 80% are using them in some form, which means, 20% aren't at all.
Right. But the interesting question for the purposes of this segment is, once you start using your mobile wallet for functionally everything, at what point can you give up your physical wallet entirely? And I didn't see any stats about how many Gen Zers or anyone else had managed to give up their physical wallet entirely, but it does seem to be something that some people are doing with some degree of success. You are absolutely right that the main reasons why you still do need a physical wallet is, number one, restaurants who drop a check on the table and expect you to drop a card on the check, and then they walk it back to the back of the restaurant and something magical happens and it comes back and you sign it. And it's such a, yeah. Like, if we get rid of that whole thing, I would be happy, but we are still a long way away from getting rid of that. That's a very standard way of paying for restaurant meals. And number two is the various points at which you need to show a driver's license, which is not just when you're pulled over by a police or when you're driving the car. It's also, you know, if you're going to at least half of the office buildings that I go to, they always ask you for ID when you want to go in. And if you try to show them like some digital thing on a phone, they are going to give you, you know, the stink eye.
And of course, when you go to the club, right, Felix?
Oh, the club knows me. My club knows me, Emily. I do right, not need to show them any ID.
But what do we... Okay, so these are all the practical complications on the road to a walletless world. What do we lose when we lose our wallets? Because going cashless...
We lose... The wallet is a chain. And we lose our chains.
I don't know. I still sort of lament the loss of like the move to cashless, because I think it puts you at a remove from your money in a way that maybe isn't good for people like trying to adhere to budgets or anything. Once you like lose the tactile, the experience of like, I have this money in my wallet and I can see it and I can count it. I know how much exactly I have and I pay for this thing and now I have this much less. Like, once you like lose touch with that, I think you're just spending money like willy-nilly everywhere. And I don't think that's good.
That was also an argument against credit cards, though, and particularly debit cards.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it really is. I remember reading a piece by Megan McArdle, of all people, many years ago, where she was like, I wanted to get a handle on my spending. And she adopted this mildly insane budgeting approach.
Is it the envelopes?
Which involves envelopes. And you literally put cash in envelope. You take all your money out in cash. You put all of the cash in envelopes. And then like each envelope is earmarked for a certain kind of expenditure. And then when you've run out of money, cash in that envelope, you know, once you've run out of cash of your, I don't know, buying gas for your car envelope, you're not allowed to buy gas for your car anymore. It seems batshit to me. But like, apparently it works quite well if you have the discipline to do it, which I don't think anyone does. What you're absolutely right that we lose, that the more abstracted that money gets, the easier it becomes to spend. And to Elizabeth's point, a credit card is much more abstracted money than physical folding cash. But it is also true that just tapping a phone, like when you don't need to like sign something, is kind of easier and more abstracted still. The easier
like
the payments
level.
Become, the easier it becomes to spend too much. I think that's
And I mean, and like if you pull back even more, like probably not good for individual budgeting or consumer financial health, but like really great for the US economy. Like a move to cashless is going to drive more consumer spending, and like that's great for like the big picture GDP and economic growth and all that. So it's kind of like a backdoor way to growth. It doesn't have to do with really productivity. Or maybe it does because it's more efficient.
The hidden Apple Pay stimulus.
Yeah. Yeah. But I don't know. I mean, I'd be curious what people think. Like, are people not using wallets anymore? I use a wallet. I just bought my daughter a wallet because she has, she's cash. She's all in cash.
Oh, is she a cash person? She doesn't have one of those like teen credit cards where you get to control what kind of items she can buy?
We haven't made that move yet. I'm sure it's coming.
I feel like teen credit cards are good because with the cash, she can spend that on anything. Whereas with the teen credit card, you have visibility into what she's buying.
That's true.
My 8-year-old has a debit card and we have an account for him where his allowance goes. And he's less likely to spend with the card because then he has to ask two people for permission to do it. If I give him cash, he's a
He needs double permission? He needs double buy-in for that?
Like you have to unlock the keys?
Yeah.
Wow. That's hardcore, Elizabeth. Like, you would think that one parent would be enough. But no, he needs like permission from both before he can spend anything.
Just to buy a candy bar?
It's not a hard rule, no. But he usually if he's looking to buy something with the card, it's a bigger ticket purchase, so we'd probably make him.
Is he intuitively, does he like spending money or does he like saving money?
He sort of goes back and forth. He'll impulse buy things like Pokemon cards, but if he's got something that he wants to save for, he's not bad about putting it away. So.
It's more fun to spend with cash, isn't it? Like, it's like you just do it and it's done and like there's no real record of it. And it's like you don't have to think about it a month later, you know, when you look at your credit card bill, it's over, you know?
Yeah, I like cashless though, because I don't like walking around with a ton of ones and a bunch of change and it's just annoying. But I also, for me, I will keep a wallet till the end of time because I lose my phone all the time. And I've lost my wallet like once. And so the idea of having them combined just means that I would lose my wallet more frequently if it's just entirely on my phone.
Oh, that's no good.
Suppose you lose your wallet on vacation.
I've no cash, no credit cards.
You have nothing.
What'll you do? What will you do?
Apple Card is the perfect cash back rewards credit card. You earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase every day. That's 3% on your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/cardcalculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City branch. Subject to credit approval. Terms apply.
Hello, I'm Imi Harper. On the Slow Newscast from Tortoise, I tell the story of how a Hong Kong billionaire was silenced.
I got bombs thrown into my house. I got people came here, ransacked my computer. And I got people fractured me. I got this and that, but I'm safe.
And what it reveals about the freedoms Hong Kong no longer enjoys. Listen to Hong Kong's Rebel Billionaire on the Slow Newscast, wherever you get your podcasts.
Let's move on and talk about carbon emissions, because this is a big deal. The SEC has finally promulgated its official rule saying that public companies, most public companies, certainly big public companies, need to report on their scope 1 and scope 2 carbon emissions. Basically, when they're out there emitting carbon, that's something that shareholders care about and that companies now need to report. And I'm like, yay, this is awesome. Would you guys agree?
I think it is. I think bigger companies are going to knee-jerk hate it because they hate any kind of additional required disclosure.
Have you seen any big companies oppose this?
Well, I don't think they would come right out and say it, but they generally push back on additional regulation generally. I think it's good for shareholders, though, because it evaluates the sort of financial materiality of climate change impacts. And that's something that if you're a shareholder, you would absolutely want to understand.
Well, no, I don't think it evaluates the financial materiality.
Well, it requires them to report it.
Yes. Yeah, it's just a reporting requirement. They don't need to say, like, this is a good amount of carbon to emit or this is a bad amount of carbon to emit. You just need to report how much carbon you're emitting.
A lot of companies lobbied really hard to get this thing watered down because the one thing it doesn't require companies to do, I guess it's called scope 3.
Right.
It doesn't require companies to report on emissions down the supply chain, which sounds boring, but if you think about it, that includes consumers. So like if I'm a car company, I don't have to think about the emissions that people make when they're driving my cars, which is like kind of a big deal and is important. So that's not in there anymore. And also companies only, it's at their discretion. They only have to report this stuff if they consider it material to their financial bottom line. But it's up to the companies to decide that. Although I suppose they could be vulnerable to shareholder suits or something if they don't.
I think most people will, though. I think this is going to be... Because it's only scope 1 and scope 2, it's relatively easy to report. Scope 3 is notoriously impossible to measure. You know, there are lots of, you know, environmental consultancy companies out there saying hire us and we will measure your scope 3 emissions for a vast amount of money. But it does cost a lot of money. There's huge error bars on it. And at least in principle, like insofar as companies are dealing with other companies, you know, the one company's scope 3 emissions is another company's scope 2 or scope 1 emissions. And so you can kind of like all add up at some point. But yeah, I'm not, I do think that if you want to sort of add up all of the emissions in SEC filings and get a feel for carbon emissions nationally, that's a terrible way of doing it. And this makes it harder to do that, but no one would do that anyway. And what's more, a lot of companies are going to be reporting their scope 3 emissions. This is the other thing that no one's really focusing on, is that California is forcing companies to report their scope 3 emissions. A bunch of European regulations are forcing companies to report their scope 3 emissions. So if they have to do it anyway for California and for Europe, they'll do it in their SEC filings too.
Yeah. I mean, the other thing, I mean, I think it's good. Any movement here is good. And there's evidence that in Europe, where companies are already doing this, that when they report their emissions, that their emissions go down. So, you know, if you measure it, you can fix it, change it, whatever. But it's the United States. And already, I think 11 attorneys general have filed a lawsuit seeking to stop this thing from going into effect. And considering the climate right now in the courts and where the Supreme Court is at when it comes to, you know, administrative agencies and environmentalism, like, I'm not optimistic that this thing will last, make it through the court process even, you know? And yes, maybe companies will start doing it anyway, but I'm just not that optimistic right now in the US. Like, companies have been pulling back from ESG, environmentalism, social governance, especially the environmentalist stuff, because they're afraid of being called woke and all this. They pulled out of some other like initiative called climate action or something. They've taken language out of reports. They're just like very afraid to do this stuff right now. And the climate just seems the climate, the vibes.
Well, the states that are suing skew a little bit redder, and they also have heavier industrial bases. So
I mean, this is something we have been talking about over in the Axios side of things quite a lot, Emily. It's like, are the companies actually pulling back from ESG and DEI stuff, or are they doing just as much ESG and DEI stuff as ever and just talking about it less and being less like shouty from the rooftops and saying like, this used to be something that would give us a good reputation, so we would get our marketing function to amplify all of the stuff that we're doing. Now it gives us a bad reputation, so our marketing function has like shut the fuck up, but we're still doing it.
I think it's a little like we're still doing it, but there are companies that are doing less stuff, or like, to broaden it out since you brought it up, on DEI, like, they're opening up programs that were once targeted towards, say, like Black women inside companies are now targeted towards everyone. And on the ESG, on the E side, you know, they are pulling out of certain initiatives, voluntary initiatives. So there is pullback. It's not just a pullback in rhetoric and marketing. It's like a real pullback.
Should we have a numbers round? Elizabeth, what's your number?
My number is 217, and that's the number of COVID boosters a 62-year-old man in Germany got over the course of 29 months.
Oh, I love this story.
A study in The Lancet indicates that he had no side effects. So for people who are worried that you can get over-boosted in some way, it makes a difference.
And they actually found like the 214th boost. Yeah, every extra COVID booster he got actually did improve his immune response a little bit better. And they were all helpful. All of them helped, at least a little bit.
They asked him why he did it, and he said, for private reasons.
Wow, what a hero.
My number, I'm going to do a really nerdy number, which is 200 billion, which is the number of euros in pools of loans that mostly European banks have offloaded in this wonderful thing called a CRT or an SCRT, which stands for Synthetic Credit Risk Transfer. And this is the other way to rescue a bank. If the Mnuch is not around coming in with $1 billion to save the day, one of the ways that European banks, especially, and also UK banks to a large degree, are being able to persuade regulators that they're loan books aren't as risky as they thought is by basically taking all of the risk of that, of those loan books, and selling that risk to outside investors, to private equity, to hedge funds, to insurance companies, that kind of stuff. And once you do that, the regulators are like, oh, you're right. You sold off all the risk. Someone else will take the loss if there's a loss. So, you know, your capital ratios have improved. And this is something that, like, if you're a bank in the US wanting to sort of optimize things and prevent yourself from falling into trouble, would be great. But the Fed seems to be of two minds about whether they love it or not. And that seems to be, and I know that New York Community Bank was reported to have been looking at this, but couldn't really get the regulators on board. But I think I suspect it's going to wind up happening in the US as well. And then that number is going to be even bigger once the American banks start getting into it. Like right now, there's been like four or five American banks mostly doing like auto loan portfolios. They're like, auto loans, that's not an important customer relationship. You know, we can sell that. We can sell off that risk and improve and free up some capital. But I think it might become bigger. So, like, you heard it here first. CRT, credit risk transfers, might be happening.
Not the other CRT.
Not critical race theory. No.
You're taking back CRT.
Exactly. We're reclaiming it for nerds to, you know, really. Although, to be fair, the original critical race theory was extremely nerdy.
Super wonky.
It is still nerdy. Yeah. We should just leave anything CRT to the nerds.
Exactly. Emily, what's your number?
My number, it's not nerdy. It's one. And that is the number of hours we lose this weekend.
Oh.
I'm not mad about it. Set your clocks ahead.
Yeah,
people.
We get sunlight now.
We get sunlight now and we lose an hour of sleep. And, you know, it's a hotly debated thing. People don't like this. People do like this. I think I land on the I don't like it because I don't like losing an hour of sleep. And the days get longer anyway. You know, it's fine. Like, we will have longer days even if we didn't do this to our clocks and our bodies. And, you know, a lot of bad stuff can happen.
The bad stuff is overwhelmingly a function of the clocks changing. Lots of bad stuff happens when they go forward. Lots of bad stuff happens when they go back. Clocks should never change.
We should never change.
We should have one fucking time zone and stick to it.
Literally one time zone.
Well, I mean, one time zone per time zone.
Okay.
The big debate is if we only have one, and almost everyone agrees that one is better than two, but there's a massive cleavage between the people who are like, the winter time zone is the one that we should have year round, and the people who say the summer time zone is the one that we should have year round. And I am saying, my point of view is very strongly that we are moving into the promised land of much, much better time zone. And the new time zone that we have, the summertime time zone, is the one that we should have year round.
Daylight savings forever.
Daylight savings forever. And like, let's not have it get dark at 3:30 in the afternoon anymore. That's horrible.
That is horrible. I agree. But I don't think I care. Just pick one. I'm okay with either. But stop changing it. No one likes it, especially parents of young kids. I remember that because little babies, they don't know about times changing. It's hard to deal with that. Let's just get rid of it all. Let's start it here and make it nationwide. I mean, I know there's a lot of action. There was some legislation last year that went nowhere.
But yeah, sleep in on Sunday. And you know what? As the host of Slate Money, I am giving you all, lovely Slate Money listeners, special dispensation to sleep in on Monday as well. You just sleep in on Monday. And if anyone asks where you were, just say, I was sleeping in because the clocks changed.
Felix will write your boss a note.
I will write your boss a note. Yeah. I think that's it for us this week. Thank you for writing in. The email address, as ever, is slatemoney@slate.com. Thank you to Jared Downing and Shana Roth for producing. And thank you for all of the lovely notes you sent me about the Gary Stephenson interview that came out on Tuesday. People really like that. And guess what? Normally, Money Talks comes out every other Tuesday, but because we have so many amazing Money Talks, we have a new one coming out this Tuesday. Emily, who's coming on?
Chloe DeMond, the director of Fair Play, which is this amazing movie on Netflix that everyone should watch before they listen. And then you can find out more about it on Tuesday. It's one of the best explorations, I think, of gender dynamics in the workplace. And that sounds dry, but This thing is, it's basically like a sexual thriller, kind of 90s throwback in that way.
All right. So Chloe Demont is coming on Tuesday. And then after that, we'll be back with a regular Slate Money on Saturday.